It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. Lots to talk about, including, yes, the new Spectre variants. We finally have the details. Steve will talk all about that and what you can do about it and what the mitigation is going to cost you. We also will talk about a new attack on your Amazon Echo device or your Google Home device. Steve and I may disagree about the seriousness of that one. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 664, recorded Tuesday, May 22nd, 2018. Spectre NG revealed. Security Now is brought to you by WordPress. Reach more customers when you build your business website on WordPress.com. Plans start at just $4 a month. Plus, get 15% off any new plan at WordPress.com/securitynow. And by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit. And by Rocket Mortgage from Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we talk about your privacy, your security, your health and happiness and well-being on the internet with Mr. Steve Gibson of the GRC Corporation. Hi, Steve!
Yay, Leo. Great to be with you again, as always.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, we scrambled here a little bit at the end.
Yes.
I was apparently watching a tape-delayed version of of Mac Break Weekly and I thought, wow, they're kind of running late.
We ended half an hour ago. No, but I also figured you had some work to do on this new Spectre flaw.
Well, yeah. 2 weeks ago, the news leaked through Heise.de, that German magazine, about this having been discovered. And they did their due diligence to verify it. And so 2 weeks ago, the title of the podcast was Spectre Next Generation. Last week, I mentioned that, okay, we were still waiting. We're still waiting. We're still waiting. And all the news dropped yesterday. So today is Spectre NG revealed.
They were presumably waiting to disclose till companies had patched and things like that. Yeah. Or?
Yes. And even so, this is what we heard was 8 new problems, one of which was a big concern.
Right.
I can't square that with the news of 2, because all we got is 2 new problems. But, you know, they are problems, and every company, essentially every processor, in this case, even the IBM power chips are vulnerable. I mean, you know, this is a fundamental, I think the thing that makes this so interesting and such a concern, and not like, oh, just do a patch, is it's a consequence of the fundamental architecture which everybody in the industry has adopted in order to get more performance, in order to squeeze every last bit of speed out of the existing technology that we have for, you know, like non-quantum, single instruction at a time. We've done all kinds of things like running multiple cores at the same time, sharing caches so that they share memory, and then going ahead. You know, like, for example, it's not if you run across a branch instruction, you take both forks of the branch. It's like, what? Well, it's because you may not yet know if you're reading ahead what the outcome of earlier instructions are that would determine whether the branch is taken or not. But if the processor has extra resources that are not being used, why not let it run ahead and then discard the results of the branch that wasn't taken? thus speculative. It's speculating on its own future. And it turns out that, you know, once it was Jan Horn at Google's Project Zero who first, like, sort of got this glimmer of like, is this really secure? And this, of course, then this was last summer this happened, that this all began, when he realized, ooh, boy, you know, because this modifies the state of the processor, it breaks trust boundaries. It breaks security boundaries between processes and like between the OS and its client applications. So, you know, this is big, and it continues to give us interesting things to talk about, which is cool too, because it's like fundamental technology, not, oh, some router,
right,
you know, like right, had a default password that they shipped. Of course, we have some of that this week too. We're going to examine the recent flaws discovered in the secure Signal messaging app for desktops, the rise in DNS router hijacking, another seriously flawed consumer router family, Microsoft's Spectre patches for the earlier Spectre problems, which appeared just the day after last week's podcast, last Wednesday, for the April 2018 feature update. A really interesting thing I know you're going to find fascinating if you haven't already read into it, the threat of voice assistant spoofing attacks. Mm. An interesting paper was released where some researchers did a very convincing job of getting the wrong malicious app to run for the Amazon and Google devices. Also, the evolving security of HTTP as being driven by Google and the strength of their Chrome browser. Still, believe it or not, more new trouble with those GPON routers. A mistake that Facebook made with their Android app that upset a lot of people. BMW's 14 security flaws. Oh, yes. Some fun miscellany, and then we'll take a look at what we just learned yesterday about this, about variant 3A and 4. We had 1, 2, and 3. Now we have 3A and 4, and what that means. And it's got, if you really want protection, get this, an 8% hit on processor performance. So, wow. Ouch.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think lots of good stuff to talk about.
All right, Steve. We're going to get underway here in a sec, but first a word from our sponsor, WordPress.com. If you visited leolaporte.com, you know that's where I have my presence on the net. Everybody, really, every individual should have a web page they call their own. Not your Facebook account, not your Twitter feed, but something that is yours and yours alone. In fact, every business ought to, too. It's even more important for a business. In fact, frankly, not having a web page for your business can be kind of like not having a Yellow Pages ad or a sign over the door. You just no one has a way of finding out more about you. That's how, I mean, even if it's a plumber, or, you know, or a roofer, I'm going to go to their website, get the phone number, find, read reviews, that kind of thing. You got to have a website. And if you're going to do it right. You're not, you know, unless you want to become an expert in web technologies, maybe you do. I know when I first set up WordPress, and I set it up when it first came out more than 10 years ago, maybe 15 years ago now, I did it all myself on my own server. And that's fine if that's what you want. But frankly, unless you're in the web design business, you'd probably be better off going to WordPress.com. Same WordPress that runs 30% of all the websites in the world. But they do the hosting. They keep it up to date. They provide all the plugins and the themes you could ever want. And even more important, they provide 24/7, Monday through Friday, tech support from great people. They're there on the weekends too. So there's never a question you can't get answered. Never a problem you can't get solved. And that is huge. I'm so glad I moved to WordPress.com. And yeah, it's also a community. You know, you could have a follow button on your page that lets other WordPress.com members follow you. And there's a front page, and you can get featured there and get a lot of traffic. So it's really more than just you know, a WordPress install. You get a whole lot with WordPress.com. They also offer e-commerce solutions. Normally, this would be hard to set up on your own. It's easy with WordPress. You flip a switch, you can have anything from a simple, you know, buy button to a full online store. Prices are very affordable. It costs me less to have a WordPress.com site than it did to host my own server. It starts as low as $4 a month. I have the business plan because I like the features of the business plan a lot. And that you'll like, too, if you're a business, things like built-in SEO, social sharing, specialized plugins. I use Google's AMP plugin, for instance. It speeds up my page loads on mobile, HTTPS across the board. That improves your Google ranking. It really is no surprise. 30% of all the websites in the world run on WordPress. Yours should, too. I want you to go to WordPress.com/security now and get 15% off any new plan purchase. 15% off any new plan purchase. WordPress.com/security now. Create your brand new website. It's all-in-one, nonstop, one-stop shopping for anybody who wants to have a great website, especially if you're a business. You really ought to do it. WordPress.com/security now. We thank them so much for supporting Security Now. And, of course, Steve's personal site's on WordPress, too, as is mine.
Yep.
On we go.
Our picture of the week, yes, is one that I've had in our log of pictures to get to, since there was nothing particularly that jumped out at me about this week's topics. But it's something that we've all experienced as often. It's a three-frame cartoon with a laptop that is shown saying there's a new update, but there are a few unsaved projects and you are gone for like 5 minutes now. May I update and restart anyway? And then the center frame sort of shows the laptop kind of waiting. And then finally the third frame, I'll take that as a yes. And of course it restarts and loses the unsaved data and so forth. So yes, the nature of automated software updates in the current PC era. The Signal protocol is secure. As far as everyone knows, Moxie and company have a lot of experience with security and security protocols. It's been looked at closely. We've done a podcast about exactly how it works. And as I was getting into it, I remember thinking, wow, this is really kind of over-designed. What? But then as I understood the set of features which they wanted the solution to have, the cleverness of what they had done was clear. And of course, I shared that on our podcast about the Signal protocol at the time. So that's different than mistakes being made in the implementation of an application which implements that protocol. So anyone who has the Signal desktop app for Windows and Linux needs to make sure that you're running the latest, which is 1.10.1. And the pre-release, which is currently in beta, of 1.11.0. Those are safe. The earlier ones, not so much. We remember Giuliano Rizzo, who was on the beach when he and his security researcher buddy discovered or came up with or realized the Beast and Crime attacks on SSL and how it was possible to cause an information leakage there. Well, they're still doing security stuff. And a couple of weeks ago, they discovered a severe vulnerability in the Signal messaging app for those two desktops, for Windows and Linux, which allows remote attackers to execute malicious code on the recipient's systems simply by sending them a message, which requires no user interaction. What was interesting was that this vulnerability that these guys discovered occurred purely by accident, they were chatting on Signal using their desktop apps, probably for Linux, knowing those guys. And one of them shared a link of a vulnerable site with a cross-site scripting payload in its URL. And the cross-site scripting payload got executed on the Signal desktop of that message recipient. And, of course, being a security researcher, I mean, if it had happened to many people, they would have gone, oh, what? That's odd. But, you know, these guys instantly realized, wait a second, this thing just ran on my desktop. So they dug into what was going on and tested a whole bunch of different payloads and figured out that the vulnerability resided in a function which was responsible for handling shared links, which allowed attackers to inject user-defined and provided HTML and JavaScript via an iframe, an image, a video, or an audio tag. I mean, basically, there were lots of ways in. And they were even able to create, to inject a fillable form onto the recipient's chat window, which could have been used in a social engineering attack to trick them into revealing sensitive information. And it's interesting that Signal is another of those apps which was built upon, is built upon the Electron application platform framework that we talked about as having some problems last week. Not clear. In fact, it doesn't look like, now that we know what's going on, that Electron was to blame. It turns out that the Open Whisper Systems guys, the people who publish Signal, had already addressed this issue previously, but somehow there was a regression in their code. The April 10th release of a Signal update reintroduced a problem which they had previously added some functions to prevent. So I imagine they'll go back and figure out how this regression occurred. However, this was responsibly disclosed. The Signal guys refixed what they had previously fixed immediately, and within hours, the desktop update was made. So but this was regarded as a pants on fire, like big security problem while it was there, because any bad guy simply had to send a Signal user a message and it would have been executed. So you do want to make sure that you're updated to the latest version of the desktop app. Now, Signal does have an auto update facility, so I imagine unless you did something to deliberately deny updates, you were probably safe before this even was known publicly, because this was also responsibly disclosed. And also there was another problem. This is the second problem. There was another problem in the Signal desktop that involved for Mac OS where disappearing messages could be recovered and be undisappeared. And that was also fixed at the same time. So as far as we know, that Signal desktop app is up and running and clean. In general, I think probably there's always sort of like best practice advice. What's the number one thing you would ask someone to do or tell someone to do or make sure people do? You know, very much like, I guess number one is probably related to passwords, where you don't want to be using the same password everywhere because of the vulnerability that creates, and you want to use a good password and so forth, not monkey. Probably right up there, although arguably much less easy to deploy as a device, is the concern about router security. Routers are really coming under attack. I don't know if we've had a week in this podcast when we haven't talked about one or more new or newly discovered or newly exploited or, you know, big problems with consumer routers. It seems that it's one of these problems where they're deployed en masse before a problem is found, and then it's very difficult to get the problem fixed. So, and it just sort of seems like it's another, you know, they're a classic case of an IoT device, but it's unique because they're very complex. They're typically running some flavor of Linux in order to offer all the features that people want in routers. And it's not even features people want. It's that manufacturers have a, you know, competitive checklist. So there's a ridiculous amount of power in these things that most people never even know about or ask for, yet it's there. And of course, we know that complexity is the enemy of security. So the other thing that makes these unique is that unlike most IoT devices, which are safely hiding behind a router, its role is to be there on the front line. So it's the device more than anything else in your entire network where security is crucial, because it's got a public-facing surface that, or attack surface, that is potentially vulnerable. So what we're finding is that DNS hijacking is, if the router's not being used, as we've been discussing in recent weeks, for hosting botnets or for using universal plug and play to bounce traffic off of its public surface in order to disguise the source of attacks. One of the other ways that the routers are being abused that is being seen now in the wild is DNS hijacking. This is a problem because it means that your most devices behind the router simply use DHCP, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, to configure the devices, whether it's your Android, your iOS, your light bulbs, or all your computers. It's, you know, the obtain IP address automatically. Well, you're not only obtaining the IP address for the main machine, you're also, through DHCP, unless you deliberately configure it otherwise, you're obtaining the DNS address for that machine. That is the two IPs which all of the systems on your network will use to look up domain names, IP addresses. Well, what this means is if that's a malicious server, that is, if something has hijacked your router's DNS so that the IP address your computer has is to a malicious DNS server, then one of the crucial assumptions of the internet for security, which is you are really going to the server you think you are going to when everything else is correct. You know, you look at the URL in your browser, www.amazon.com, no misspellings, no umlauts, no Unicode snuck in there. It absolutely is www.amazon.com. You're sure of it. Well, you need DNS to send you to the proper IP for Amazon.com. Now, the trick, the problem that hijackers have is unless they're able to somehow get a security certificate for Amazon.com, which is increasingly difficult thanks to the CA system really working hard to improve its security, then you might, then it's probably unlikely that they can get you to an HTTPS connection. But it's often the case that users aren't paying attention. And so you might well be at http://amazon, www.amazon.com, and think everything is fine when you're in fact at a spoof site. And it then pops up a page saying, oh, you know, your login has timed out. It's been too long since you've been here. Please, you know, log in again. And so that's a way that bad guys have of obviously acquiring your username and password at a site which has been spoofed. All of this to say that in the news this week is yet again widespread DNS hijacking malware, which has recently been found to be targeting Android devices, and has also recently updated its capabilities to target iOS and desktop users. It's called the Roaming Mantis malware, and has been hijacking internet routers in the last month to distribute various kinds of malware. Kaspersky Labs have been tracking this and have been posting the news that this thing is spreading strongly. There's a router that it's been compromising from Draytech, which is a Taiwanese manufacturer. They make routers, switches, firewalls, and VPN devices. And there is a zero-day vulnerability in those particular routers, which is being used to change its DNS settings. So it's not clear where the geographic spread of these routers is, if they're only being sold to specific ISPs to provide them to their customers, or what the retail path is. But if you happen to know that you have a Draytech router on the shelf, you want to absolutely make sure that you've got it updated. Draytech is aware of the problem. They were informed by Kaspersky, who found this particular DNS hijacking malware roaming around the internet. They've got a really long list of router model numbers of their manufacturer, which are vulnerable. So if you happen to have a Draytech router, it's the latest victim of DNS hijacking. But even if you don't, I would say probably worth just maybe taking, logging into your router and just making sure that nothing has configured your router settings, or just take a look at your own DHCP settings for your machine and make sure that it's what you expect them to be. In some cases, that may not be enough because your system might be using the router's gateway as its DNS. That's often the case, so that your queries go to the router, which it then forwards to public DNS servers. So it's probably necessary to check the router. As I said, it's not as simple. It's not simple consumer-oriented advice to follow, but unfortunately, the danger is real. This is something which is becoming increasingly widespread as routers are falling victim to one exploit after another. I also wanted to mention last podcast, we talked about the firmware updates the latest Intel microcode firmware updates for all versions of Windows 10 up to but not including, which was sort of a head scratcher we talked about at the time, for this latest the April 2018 feature update, which is version 1803 to Windows 10. The day after that, last Wednesday, Microsoft added the microcode updates for 1803 and 1803 Windows Server. So those are available. I've got the link in the show notes. It's KB4100347. So if you are running 1803 and you haven't updated to this, KB4100347 will give you the latest. I mean, just across all of the chips that Intel is going to update for that latest version of Windows 10. I did see that this was going to be pushed out both through the go get it yourself and the regular Windows update mechanism. I didn't look. I should have checked to see whether my Windows 10 which I did verify this morning that there are no updates for it available, whether it had already grabbed that and brought itself current. But in any event, you may want to. Okay, now the Leo, this is what I think. This is going to catch your fancy. And perhaps it was inevitable. We were just talking about, you know, making sure that Amazon.com was actually Amazon and not Amazon.com. Because for years, look-alike phishing attacks have used, you know, look-alike domain names. Well, now we have voice assistant, and we have phishing of sound-alike trigger phrases, which, when you think about it, shouldn't surprise us at all. In a just published research paper titled "Understanding and Mitigating the Security Risks of Voice-Controlled Third-Party Skills on Amazon," and you know the name of that device, the Echo, and Google Home, a group of Chinese and U.S. researchers describe their various methods of attacking smart assistants. Those made by, I'm working hard not to say the A word.
Say Echo, that's okay.
Oh, Echo, yes. Yeah. But everywhere in the coverage, they're talking about the Amazon A word. So we've already talked about previously the problem of applications maliciously and deliberately leaving the microphone on, staying active in the background, and then streaming microphone, whatever the microphone receives, off onto the internet. These guys do describe that, but they also describe and they convincingly demonstrate a more worrisome, and I don't know what Amazon and Google are going to do about this, attack, which they call voice squatting. The idea is to trick the user into opening a malicious application by using voice triggers which are acoustically similar to the ones of authentic apps. And then, of course, using the malicious apps to phish users for sensitive data or eavesdrop on their surroundings or do whatever. So, for example, an attacker might register an app that triggers on the phrase open capital one, but spelled W-O-N, that is as in winning and losing, you know, one, which is obviously sounds similar to open capital one, O-N-E, which is the real intended trigger for that phrase. How does the voice assistant know? So they demonstrate in their paper, for example, there is an Amazon Echo skill named Rat Game, and they registered a what they call an attack skill, Rap, R-A-P game. And the very fact that I had to spell it demonstrates the problem of the skill. It sounds almost identical. And sure enough, in their testing, having registered this Rap game after it being registered, when someone wants to open Rap game with a P, the attack skill wins preferentially. That they did that over on the Amazon side. For Google Assistant, they registered the attack skill Intramatic Opener, which sounds very similar to an existing target skill, Entramatic Opener. And again, when users tried to invoke Entramatic Opener, they got Intramatic Opener instead. And then in one additional skill, or one additional, and I thought very clever attack, they experimented with making a more specific request. For example, they registered Rat R-A-T, game please, so that if the user says to the Amazon Echo device, you know, a word, open rat game, please. Well, that's a more specific match than just rat game. And again, that get if the extra please is added on the end, it matches more strongly than without it. And again, the attack skill is executed. So these guys put together the paper, demonstrated, and you know, their proof of concept. They've notified both Amazon and Google, who have both responded and said, thank you for your report. We're looking into it. But boy, Leo, I don't know how you solve this problem.
Yeah, but so I mean, what?
So,
imagine, so how would you use this maliciously? Besides, you got the wrong game.
Well, or the wrong
It then
anything.
Says, tell me your bank password, and you're going to tell it your bank password? No.
Certainly, you don't think so?
No, you never do that on an Echo. No one would fall for that. I don't think so. I think this is more, you know, on the equivalent of getting somebody's computer to do something silly than anything.
Okay.
Seriously dangerous. I mean, I'm trying to think of an attack surface. You can't with the banking app. You can't transfer money to somebody. Most of these apps are really very limited. So you could. I mean, it's more like a kid could get something funny happening to you.
Okay.
I mean,
so just sort of like so just well, like I
I'm trying to
I
think
guess,
of how this would be maliciously abused.
If nothing else, it causes the device to misbehave, to do something that you don't want
right,
it to.
Right.
So
that's annoying.
So well,
but that
it's
happens
annoying,
all the time, by the way.
Reduces,
anytime you're using an Echo, it's not unusual for. I mean, you use Siri sometimes, right? Doesn't she get you wrong about three quarters?
I don't use any voice things.
Well,
so,
try. I mean, Siri gets you wrong half the time. It's annoying.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd have to be. I guess you could make. Okay, I'm playing rap game now, and it's asking for my bank password. I don't know why, but I'm going to give it to you. I mean, that's a pretty long stretch.
I guess the problem is that we're using a very soft match technology.
Oh, yeah. It's not good. I agree.
To cause things to happen. And so it's a fundamental problem with voice.
Right.
And
it's
so
similar
now,
to the problem, though, of a web page, as you said, Amazon instead of Amazon. But I think it has less long-term utility in terms of maliciousness.
Yeah.
You know, if I get you to Amazon.com and I can ask for your Amazon password reasonably, but I don't know what you're going to do with a voice app to screw somebody up.
Yeah, I guess so.
Have you ever entered the wrong address? We all do it. And you get some strange page, right?
Yeah.
It's equivalent to that.
Well, in this case, though, I mean, you know, both Amazon and Google want their systems to work as well as they can. And this is a problem which will be – it's hard to see how they mitigate this.
Well, that's right. I mean, you'd have to have – I think what you do is you block duplicate accounts based on phonemes, not on spelling. Something like that.
Yeah, exactly. So
that would eliminate capital W O N.
Exactly. Yes. So you start to look at for deliberate attacks for sound alike registration phrases and disallow those.
Right.
Which clearly they're not doing at this point.
No.
Yeah. I just think you know it's at this point we're in the early stages, but. You know, I immediately think of Stacy, who's got like her entire world is, you know, controlled by, you know, her whole house and everything. And if you're running a mischievous voice controlled app that is there in place of something legitimate, it could probably get up to some mischief with you. But, you know, again, it's not going to probably steal your bank account.
No, it's a vandalism kind of attack. Oh, we're going to turn the thermostat up to 80.
Well, and again, though, it is an attack on the integrity of a system that more and more people are using and wanting to use.
Right.
So I wouldn't be surprised if someone were to come up with, you know, someone clever were to come up with something that, you know, cause some trouble. So
it's
we'll
conceivable.
See.
I mean, you could have a, you know, some sort of sales app that would, I don't know. I mean, I'm really working to come up with something here.
So Chrome is Google, and their Chrome browser is continuing to move their intent to secure the web through using the power of the presence. Like, you know, they're now the majority web browser. So they're able to force change, as we have seen with them, for example, forcing the early wind down of SHA-1 certificates prior to its already sort of more slowly planned withdrawal, because their browser was going to stop honoring them earlier than the rest of the industry. Right now, when we go to a secure TLS encrypted site using HTTPS, they show us the little lock icon and then a big comforting green secure to say, yes, this is a secure connection. So with Chrome 68, which is slated for release in a month and a half in July, they will start showing not secure for HTTP. So right now, they're silent on HTTP. They give you the green, happy, secure for HTTPS. In 68, in July, they'll start saying not secure. Then for 69, Chrome 69 in September, they are going to remove the secure, the happy green secure, probably because they'd like to just have more room for the URL. It takes up a chunk of space up there in that space. So they'll only show the lock. Google has stated that since most traffic is now HTTPS anyway, they feel that it's no longer necessary to draw the user's attention to the secure indicator, that being just sort of the de facto. And so instead, Chrome will start focusing on highlighting situations when the user is accessing an insecure website. So in September, in July, 68 will start saying not secure if you're on HTTP. And then in the next one after, in Chrome 70, which I don't have the date for that, probably either at the very end of 2018 or maybe the beginning of 2019, they're going to further amplify that not secure indication by, if you start entering data into a form on a non-HTTP site. And what would really be interesting is to know whether it's, because we've talked about this at length, whether it's the submission URL, which is not HTTPS, or whether the page where you're filling the data in is not HTTPS. It'd be interesting to see which of those they choose, or maybe both. Maybe they just want it both to be an HTTPS page and an HTTPS submission. Anyway, they're going to animate that not secure by turning it red to like really call the user's attention to the fact that they're entering data into a site which is not HTTPS. So again, they're determined to move the industry away from HTTP. Over the grumblings of people who argued that their site just has no need for it. On the other hand, I do support the idea that a site that is wanting data from a user, it could be benign. It might be that it really doesn't need security, but chances are what a user is putting into a form, you know, they would like to not have eavesdropped on. So highlighting the fact that where they're putting the data in isn't secure, it's probably a good thing. GPON routers are still and again in the news. The infected 17,000 of these GPON routers that we've been talking about the last few weeks have been infected with the Satori botnet. They're now scanning port 3333, which is used by the Ethereum miner known as Claymore. It turns out that there's a zero-day flaw in the Claymore mining software, which exposes it when it's publicly exposed on port 3333. This new botnet, this Satori botnet, has added its own skill looking for those Ethereum mining rigs. And if found, they reconfigure the Ethereum miner to join the dwarf pool mining pool and use the attacker's Ethereum wallet. So yet another example of where routers are being put to a bad purpose. And just to finish up on GPON routers, we already knew of 2 zero-day exploits, which we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that the Chinese researchers at 360 NetLab had discovered. Well, they found a botnet running a third previously unknown flaw. So we also talked about how there were 5 different botnets fighting for dominion over those GPON routers. Hey Jimmy, Metal, Mirai, Mustic, and Satori. To that, we now add a 6th one called the Moon. And it's currently winning because it's exploiting a new, previously unknown zero-day for which there is no patch allowing it to take over these GPON routers. And, of course, remember that since GPON stands for Gigabit Passive Optical Network, this suggests that the routers in question are well connected to the Internet, which makes them extremely valuable as DDoS attack platforms, as scanners for other vulnerabilities, and maybe if they're able to run gigabit fiber, they have beefier processors, so they could even be used usefully for some bit mining, or Bitcoin mining, or cryptocurrency mining. So, it's really looking like, as I said at the top, consumer routers are the target for attackers. And we had previously been talking about how the good news was they were just being used for attack reflection or purposes that didn't cause a subversion of the user's network. But if they start saying, well, while we're here, let's point DNS to our own malicious DNS server in order to perpetrate those effects, then, that becomes certainly a lot less than benign.
Is GPON a brand name or a description of a type of router? What is...
It's not clear to me. The company is Dasan, DASAN, a South Korean manufacturer of these GPON home routers.
I think it's a technology, right?
Well,
so there might be multiple routers using GPON, or
We know there are multiple ISPs using them, and so GPON stands for Gigabit Passive Optical Network, but it might be an acronym that they use on their own routers to as a brand name of what they also are.
Yeah.
So sort of both.
Hmm.
And Leo, we're 40 minutes in. Actually a little bit more than that. Let's take a break.
Let's talk protecting yourself with LastPass. How about that?
I like it.
Yeah. You know, I asked the LastPass folks where Joe is, and he's kind of semi-retired.
Yeah.
Which is great. Good for him. But, of course, LastPass continues on, and one of those products you never want to retire. It's the first product I put on every device I get, whether it's a phone, a laptop, a tablet, a computer. I got to have LastPass because that's how I get into everything else. In fact, it's really a real convenience when I get a new phone. I put on LastPass. LastPass is a password vault, a password manager. So let me actually talk about what a password manager means. I mean, the vault is the number one thing. It keeps track of all your passwords, so you don't have to remember them. You remember one password that unlocks the entire vault. But it does a lot more. I mean, one of the reasons I put it on my phone, new phone immediately is because it fills in the passwords. As I install applications, all my app passwords are in LastPass, so it makes it much easier for me to install the applications that I need. When you're on your browser, LastPass has plugins, by the way, for every single browser out there. It'll do the same thing for websites, automatically fill it in. Now, there's an advantage to having this vault remember your password. You don't have to, which means you can have a good password. One of the real flaws in passwords is if you have to remember it, chances are you're going to do one of two terrible things. And I know the Security Now audience knows this. One is you're just going to use the same password over and over again, or a variant thereof. Or two, you're going to make the password easy to remember by, you know, making your dog's name and your birthday and your star sign or something like that. And that means it's easy to crack. The best passwords, Steve said it many, many times, are truly random, long passwords, exactly the kind of thing no one can remember, exactly the kind of thing LastPass will generate for you. And the LastPass password generation tool is so great. You can say how long it is, and I mean, you can make them really long, too, as long as the site will let you, usually. You can have it be upper and lowercase letters, numbers, punctuation. They even have a nice feature, which I really use, which is to avoid ambiguous characters. So a zero and an O, for instance, so that they're, you know, easily, or you can do this too, which I don't do, but I think some people really like, make it pronounceable so that it's generally, that means it's all letters, right? So that you could read it and maybe that's easier to remember. I just say have at it, make it 64 characters, completely random from the entire character set. And the beauty of LastPass is it'll do it and it'll remember it. Now, if you're a business, you really want to use LastPass. I told the story. We had an engineering manager who decided it was so hard to remember all the passwords for all of our accounts and servers and everything. He just put them on a website so that he could easily get to them. He's not working for us anymore. And it was right after that that we started using LastPass Enterprise for everything. In fact, we like LastPass so much. I'd been using it for years. You gave it your seal of approval, Steve, I know. You talked to Joe. You took a look at all the code. We liked it so much, we moved the entire business to LastPass Enterprise and offered the personal version to every one of our employees for free as a kind of a benefit. The benefit is to us and them, because if they're using secure password technology, we're safer. You're going to want to use LastPass in your business. It is awesome. 81% of breaches, 81% are caused by weak passwords. Might as well use a strong password. Protect your business and your employees. They also make it very easy to share. So we have different passwords, different permissions, different folders. So the DevOps get one, you know, get one set of passwords. The administrative staff gets another set. That's great. Of course, it's all encrypted at device level with AES 256-bit encryption. LastPass doesn't have access to your password vault. They have strong two-factor, a variety of different kinds. I use a YubiKey, but you can use Duo. You can use Google Authenticator. LastPass has its own authenticator you could use too. So LastPass, besides Enterprise, has LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for the entire family. That's another nice feature. Lisa and I share passwords because there's family passwords. You know, log into the cable TV account, the PG&E account, things like, you know, the power account. So we have a folder. I move a password in there. It's shared with Lisa automatically. That's awesome. LastPass, if you're a small business, for Teams, is for Teams 50 or less. At work, at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. And I'm sincere. It's the first app I install no matter where I am. The first plugin I put on Chrome, on Firefox, on Safari, on Edge, the first app I install on my mobile devices. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. And if you're going to do it, please use that URL so they know you heard it on Security Now. lastpass.com/twit. See which product's right for you and start doing the right thing, securing your most precious stuff. All right, Steve, back to you.
So, yeah, thank you. So, this was sort of a tempest in a teapot. There was a mistake made in the Facebook app for Android that probably could not have come at a worse time, given all of Facebook's recent privacy controversies. It turned out it was the result of an innocent coding error in a beta release of the Facebook app for Android. But what it did was to cause a permission pop-up asking the user to give the app super user root level access. And of course, a lot of people said, what? And there was a lot of Twitter traffic. Security researchers looked into what was going on and determined that the package appeared to be triggering the super user, appeared to be triggering this super user pop-up was something known as White Ops, which is an SDK which Facebook was in the process of deploying, used for detecting fraud and implementing domain white and black lists. So, you know, if they didn't intend to have anything get super user root level access, a Facebook spokesperson confirmed that the pop-up dialogue was caused by a coding error. Facebook said a coding error in one of our anti-fraud systems caused a number of people running the Facebook app and certain permission management apps on rooted Android phones to see a request for additional access permissions. They said, we do not need or want these permissions. We've already fixed the issue. We apologize for any confusion. So it generated a bit of a firestorm on the internet with people saying, wait a minute, what's going on here? And it was, you know, it was a mistake and, you know, those things can happen. We've talked in the past about the Tencent team at Keen Labs. They have a great, well-earned reputation for hacking autos. And they spent, it turns out, pretty much all, actually a little more than 12 months, all of 2017, starting from January 2017 through the first month or two of 2018, looking closely at the security of BMW automobiles. And the short version is, as a result, BMW is now working on firmware updates to fix 14 flaws, which were found to affect the I-Series, the X-Series, and the 3, 5, and 7 series cars, dating back to 2012. And that's an estimate based on the components that they found to be insecure and when those components first appeared in use in the BMWs. The good news is the exploitation of the flaws is difficult. It can be done remotely, but it apparently requires access to a GSM cell tower, which we know that there are spoofed GSM cell towers, so maybe you could do it with a like creating a spoofed connection, a cellular connection to the car. But and it can also be done with a USB connection. But both the researchers and BMW agreed that the dangers are high end, and that is to say, requires a high level of skill in order to perpetrate the attack, and do not represent imminent danger to the car's owners. Yet they do need to be fixed. While you were on vacation most recently, Leo, Father Robert and I talked about the topic of the CAN bus in cars and the fact that there are high-speed, high-performance CAN buses and low-speed CAN buses. And in fact, it's not just one CAN bus. There's now, in contemporary vehicles, multiple CAN buses with firewalls that are deliberately there to decide what can cross from one CAN bus to the other. So it's often the case that the point of entry is through the so-called infotainment systems in the cars, but that while, yes, you may be able to change the radio or play with the dashboard, you're not able to affect steering or braking or, you know, driver critical vehicle safety related systems, because those are deliberately on an isolated bus. It wasn't clear because in the paper they talked about being able to penetrate the car's CAN bus security, but the reason it's not clear is they're giving BMW all of this year to get this fixed.
We've talked about it before too. I mean, part of the problem is sometimes car manufacturers only have one CAN bus network, but they depend on some sort of barrier that is not always perfect to prevent the telematics systems from getting to the drive systems. That's the real attack, right? The attack is hard enough to get on the bus, but once you get on the bus, then to get through the security that keeps you from accessing the brakes and stuff.
Unless you want
to... We've talked to guys who do that. I mean, you saw the 60 Minutes story. I mean, people can
I mean, and it is absolutely the case that you don't want something malicious in your car, regardless. And, spoofing things like how much gas you have left could be an annoyance. If it led you to believe that your tank was full and you suddenly ran out of gas, it's like, wait a minute, because that kind of stuff, the dashboard stuff, we have seen multiple compromises of that. So it looks like all of the passenger UI is on one side often,
right?
And engine and collision and braking and acceleration, there have been instances, and even driving or steering, there have been instances of compromises there, but I think more for demo, purposes.
Charlie Miller, remember, he had that hack where he wirelessly could get into a car and steer it into a ditch.
Yes.
Yeah. That was pretty scary.
It's certainly the case that car manufacturers are taking the security of these systems very seriously. When I saw that they're not going to disclose details, they have a nice paper talking about like with charts showing. I have the link to their PDF in the show notes, showing a chart of things found, like 14 different flaws and where they are and so forth, but no explicit discussion of them because they want to give BMW, first of all, time to fix them, but then it also requires that the car, if maybe it can be an over-the-air fix, but maybe it's, take the car in to have it serviced, and then while the car is in the shop having its oil changed, it gets itself updated. It's not clear what the path would be to get it fixed, but they are giving BMW plenty of time, which I think is due, and especially given the fact that it requires a high-end attack. These guys had to work to make it happen, and even then, it's not clear that it's more than just a nuisance. But as we know, many attacks start as a nuisance and can escalate from there. I have some fun miscellany. We've talked about often Star Trek. Of course, Shields Up is the name of my rather famous port scanner at GRC. I just wanted to mention that Discovery on CBS, even though it was all access and it upset a lot of people, including myself, it's been renewed for second season, and that there are as a whole collection of additional Trek movies in development. So Star Trek continues to live. Also, many of our listeners were huge fans as I was of the Expanse series on Sci-Fi. Really, the books were great. I read them deliberately before the series began. I have not yet caught up and watched the second and third seasons. We just finished with season three, and Sci-Fi announced that they were going to cancel the series. However, Jeff Bezos is a huge fan, and he's now in talks to pick up the production and plans to produce, given that everything proceeds as expected, to produce a fourth season. So for fans of The Expanse who have watched all three, I'll be catching up here at some point because the first season was excellent. There will be a fourth.
Yay.
And Leo, you'll get a kick out of this. You were right to be skeptical about the EM drive, which we talked about. I couldn't sell you on the idea that maybe there was a reactionless space drive that was somehow possible, that apparently we were told NASA researchers had, you know, built a chamber and had this somehow this reactionless drive that used microwaves in a specially formed cavity to resonate. And it was apparently generating some thrust. And you were at the time, you were like, uh-huh. Yeah, I'm
well, it
I'm
just
not
violates Newtonian physics, but, not that that couldn't happen. They have to – it's a high bar to put across.
So it turns out that Germans got involved.
Oh, they know what they're doing now. You got to trust the Germans, yeah.
They know what they're doing. They left no stone unturned. They used a super high vacuum so that, you know, like heating of the air in the chamber could be ruled out. They used mu metal in order to mute and absorb magnetic lines of force. And they did. They said, okay, you know, we need to determine for sure whether these fringe drive, you know, space drives work or don't. So they built up a system. They implemented their own version, very carefully, Germanly crafted, of an EM drive, and it produced thrust.
Ooh.
Then they said, what? And they looked more closely. It turns out that the shield, the magnetic shielding, was incomplete just for convenience sake. It turned out it was very difficult to shield it from the Earth's magnetic field completely, and that the DC power delivery to the EM drive was interacting with the Earth's magnetic field, and as you know, electromagnetically pushing this thing. So that kind of rules it out, because by definition, we cannot take the Earth with us into space to get acceleration, since leaving the Earth behind is the whole point. And a space drive which reduces to a simple magnet and coil is not going to get us anywhere, literally.
Too bad.
So,
doesn't have enough impulse to use it as a, you know, a subsonic transport around the world, or does it?
No. And even
you'd
in
be
space,
going like
Leo,
2 miles an hour.
Yes, and even in space, it would require a great deal of patience.
Yeah.
Okay. To like, okay, we're accelerating. Wait, are we going any faster than we were last year?
A little bit.
Not much. Not enough to make a difference.
Oh, well.
I found a nice note from a Jeff Karpinski in Elizabeth, Colorado. His subject was Spinrite does you know what. On May 18th, he sent it to me. He said, hey, Steve, happy Spinrite owner for over a decade. Used it many times on conventional drives, but today was a first for me and SSD. He said, my shop PC which runs CNC for my laser cutter and mill, became sluggish all of a sudden. Oops, and we know what that can often mean. He said a peek at the Windows system logs showed an explosion of drive write failure warnings. Promptly rebooted into SpinWrite, and I did a quick level one. For a quick assessment. He said it's only a 250 gig drive, so the scan took just a few minutes. Sure enough, some issues in the early sectors. He says reran SpinWrite at level two, and it took an hour or so to beat through the problem spots. After SpinWrite finished, blessing the bits, as he put it in quotes, everything was back to normal. PC performance was back, and Windows logs were quiet. He says, now my question, if SSD writes are truly randomized across the media as marketing claims, why were the bad sectors on my drive largely contiguous and localized at the beginning of the drive? He says, also, the smart window showed no issues being reported whatsoever. Not very smart in my book. He says, I'm not trusting this drive anymore, so I'll pick up a second drive this weekend and let Windows mirror it. Thanks, as always, for a fabulous product, and keep up the great work with Security Now. He says, now I'm retired. It's the only podcast that I listen to. So, Jeff, thank you. And to answer your question, the SSD controller performs the mapping from logical sectors on the drive to physical sectors spread out across the actual physical surface. So the sectors at the beginning are where the OS typically resides, and they're the ones that get the most use. But they're logically positioned at the beginning of the drive, not physically positioned at the beginning of the silicon. So they are, in fact, spread out, but normally they're not being recycled unless you're writing to them. And probably there was a lot of reading being done, but not a lot of writing. So what happens, remember that SSDs are just little tiny capacitors. They have charge stranded on a floating gate, which the technology is able to sense that charge. Over time, the charge can and does leak off. And so this is one reason why running SpinWrite on an SSD is so useful, is whereas hard drives' magnetism tends to be a fundamentally permanent facet of a magnetized surface. The SSD is just got some electrons kind of suspended in limbo, and you're hoping they all stay there, but there's a tendency for them to wander off. So what happened was, when you ran SpinWrite on level one, which is only a read pass, it immediately detected, whoa, we got some problems here reading, just passively reading these sectors. And so what it then did when you ran it on level two was when it found problems reading, it then did recovery and rewrites, which strengthened, essentially recharged those little capacitors on the SSD. And maybe then the controller relocated physically, again, used its drive leveling which is trying to level where the writes occur. It may then, when SpinWrite rewrote those troubled sectors, it would have physically moved them. But when you're only reading, that's not considered a destructive process. But it is, unfortunately, one where after time, you can start having significant problems. And as we know, something slowing down is a good early sign of reading requiring more time, which is a clue that it's probably a good time to run SpinRite. So, and as for smart not being very smart, it is the case that not all drives choose to publish what they're doing publicly. This is one of the biggest annoyances of hard drives, is that there is no way to force a manufacturer's behavior. Back in the day, Compaq was able to and did force, they had so much marketing strength that they were able to force hard drive manufacturers to publish what was going on behind the scenes. Otherwise, Compaq would not purchase their drives. So they forced this to happen. And over time, people are somewhat belatedly still doing it, at war in this case, just saying, you know, trust us. It's an SSD. It's like, no.
So you shouldn't use an SSD for backup because it'll eventually just leak out all the information.
Correct. Long term. You know what is still the most reliable is magneto-optical storage, yeah, or even electro-op, or just standard optical storage. The archivists are still using, you know, really good optical storage.
A CD or a DVD kind of?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Huh. Because that's a state change which is reliable. There can be an oxidation problem. So gold is good to use, right, as the substrate.
Right.
And then, of course, keep them in a dark place.
Right.
An SSD, if you did do it, you'd want to put it and by the way, I heard a comment about the other day on one of your podcasts about whether Steve still had his Trios in the refrigerator.
Yes, and do you?
Yes, I.
Why?
Yes, I
do. No, Steve.
My tungsten. Well, because, you know, nothing made me. Why not? I don't need the room.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, did you buy extra refrigerator space for this?
No.
No. You keep it in the freezer or the fridge?
I have no food in my fridge. So, you know, there's lots of room. I have lots of room for unused PDAs.
So you open Steve's fridge. There's no mustard. There's no ketchup. There's
just
no,
milk for there's, lattes.
There's milk and there's hard drives
and batteries.
Gadgets and batteries.
Yeah.
That is hysterical.
Yeah.
And not surprising at all.
chemical things that you want to keep cool. Yeah.
Wow. Can we take a break?
Let's take our last break, and we'll talk about Spectre Next Generation.
I'm excited, but first a word from our sponsor, Rocket Mortgage. Talk about the future. Rocket Mortgage is here today to make your life easier. If you're buying a house or you're refinancing your house, Rocket Mortgage is the way to do it. It comes from Quicken Loans. I should really say that up front, because that's the best-known name in mortgage lending, right? They're not only the biggest mortgage lender in the country. They're number one in customer satisfaction 8 years in a row. That's how you get to be the biggest. That's according to J.D. Power. So, you know, a third party, absolutely trustworthy. I think Quicken Loans is also cool because they're very technologically savvy. Dan and his team have always really been thinking about how they can reinvent this process. They've always felt like the mortgage experience was getting dated. You know, they need a technological revolution. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. It's an entirely online mortgage approval process. Now, they haven't figured out how to do the paper signing entirely online yet. Actually, they probably know exactly how they'd like to do it, but given that these things take time. But what's nice is, I never talk about this, but we have a number of people. I think Brad Sam's got a home loan from Rocket Mortgage. He said, yeah, you do the whole thing online. It takes a few minutes. You do it on your phone. You answer a few simple questions. They give you all, you know, they get all the financial information with your permission from their partners in the financial industry. And then based on income and assets and credit, they'll offer you the loans you qualify for. You choose the rate, the term, the down payment. All that's very transparent. You'll understand every step of the way what's going on. And then within, you know, 10 minutes or less, in most cases, they can approve a loan for you. So that means you could do it at an open house and 10 minutes later have a loan. I have to tell you, somebody who's bought many houses over the last 10, 20 years. I guess we bought our first house when Abby was about a year old, so 25 years. That takes a long time usually. Last time we bought a house, Lisa and I took two or three months. We were on vacation. They kept saying, can you fax us something? It's like, fax? I'm on a cruise ship. I can't fax you anything. It was crazy. Rocket Mortgage does it in 10 minutes. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, it is an entirely online mortgage approval process. But when you get the loan and you buy the house, they haven't figured this out. You still have to sign papers. Who knew? But Brad, told me this. They send a notary to your house with all the papers, so you don't even you still don't have to leave the house. They make it as easy as can be. It's convenient. It's powerful. It's transparent. You mortgage with confidence. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently, they say, at rocketmortgage.com/security now. Now would be a good time, if you're thinking about buying a new house or refinancing, to go and set up the account there. That'll take minutes off the whole time. So, I mean, it's like this. rocketmortgage.com/security now. They're an equal housing lender. They're licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030. rocketmortgage.com/security now. You're in the 21st century. Make it like the 21st century when you get a home loan. rocketmortgage.com/security now. All right, back on you, Steve.
We certainly are in the 21st century of security problems.
Oh,
that's
No kidding.
So, okay. As I mentioned at the top of the podcast, it was pretty clear when we first learned at the top of this year, at the beginning of the year, that speculative execution and also cashing, because that's what Meltdown was about, all which were in place for performance were in trouble. The problem was that they fundamentally used resources that were shared among processes, and they, in order to function, a cache is inherently a history of what's been done, using the fact that what is about to happen is often related to what has just happened in computer code. So if you remember what you've done, maybe you have it on hand if you need to do it again in the short term. So so any kind of a history means that what has happened recently alters the speed of what happens next. And if you are very careful at noticing your own execution speed, it tells you about the past, which, incredibly enough, attackers can use in order to leak information from other from areas of a system they should not have access to. Okay, so we initially had three variations of this problem. Collectively, they were known as Meltdown and Spectre. We had variant 1 and 2 were Spectre, and variant 3 was Meltdown. 1 and 3 were relatively easily solved with some software changes, that is, like OS level changes. That second one, that Spectre variant 2, that was the pesky one. That was the branch prediction speculation problem, which required turning branch prediction off. And that's why it had a big performance impact if you chose to do it, because being able to predict which way a branch would go in the ability of the processor to fetch instructions ahead allowed it to keep the memory bandwidth channel saturated. Memory is still the slowest thing. You know, DRAM is slow, which is why we have typically three levels of caching in order to just try to feed the hungry multi-core chips we have with DRAM, which stubbornly refuses to go any faster. We've talked about promising and hopeful future technologies. There are some, you know, HP's working on that cross-point memory, which would potentially give us DRAM density at static RAM, that is, at cache RAM speed, which would completely change everything. I mean, it just would revolutionize, but it hasn't happened yet. And they seem to be stalled because they were supposed to already have, you know, test devices out by now. So who knows what's happening there? But the problem with turning off one of these features is that it hurts us. That is, it's there because it helps our performance so much. So if you make it not there anymore for the sake of security, you get a performance hit. So now we know what happened 2 weeks ago. That is, the news hit that there was some more problems found. And it shouldn't surprise any of us that that was the case, because the things we've done in our chips, and by we, I mean everybody, AMD, ARM, IBM, with several of their processors, and of course Intel, everybody has done this in order, because it's the way you squeeze more performance out of your architecture. So consequently, now everybody is in trouble and is watching all of these things very carefully. What we knew 2 weeks ago is that new problems had been found. We heard, you know, Heise.de reported 8 new problems. I don't know where the other 6 are, but we now have information, good information, complete information about 2 new problems, which are being called 3A and 4. Of the two, variant 4, which is a Spectre problem, is the big problem. What's interesting is that both Google and Microsoft security researchers independently discovered these problems just because everybody is now looking deeply into other possible ways that our contemporary speed up architectures can be leveraged. So you know, and remember that, like, for decades, we have all been sort of merrily going along with processing architectures that could be exploited in this fashion. Yet it wasn't until last summer that I'm blanking on his name. I have it here. The guy at Google's Project Zero.
Travis Kalanick?
No, not Travis in this case. Oh, Jan, J-A-N-N Horn at Google. He was the original discoverer of the Meltdown and Spectre flaws. So, and he was the guy at Google, along with people at Microsoft, who figured out that there was more trouble that still had to be resolved. So, there's the variant 3A is known as the Rogue System Register Read, which is a variation of the Meltdown flaw. Variant 4 is speculative store bypass, and that's the one that's most worrisome and the one that requires yet another microcode update. So we've got more microcode updates coming. Red Hat is involved because, of course, they want to secure Linux against this. So they explain that variant 4 relies upon the presence of a precisely defined instruction sequence in the privileged code. Now, of course, that's not hard to achieve because everyone can disassemble other people's code. So, you know, open source makes it super easy, but even closed source. The idea is that, as we know, contemporary security technology does not rely on unknown code, that is, unknown algorithms. It relies on unknown keys. There's no bar being set by requiring precisely defined instruction sequences to be known or unknown. We, you know, everybody has that. And they continue saying, as well as the fact that memory read from an address to which a recent memory write has occurred may see the previous value and subsequently cause an update to the microprocessor's data cache even for speculatively executed instructions that never actually commit. So that is to say, remember that if the processor executes speculatively, assuming that a certain branch will be taken, then it can cause some change, even though that it ends up throwing away all of that work it did if a different branch got taken. So Microsoft just yesterday, I mean, this has just all come to light and happened. Yesterday, Microsoft said in January 2018, Microsoft published an advisory and security updates for a new class of hardware vulnerabilities involving speculative execution side channels known as Spectre and Meltdown. In this blog post yesterday, we will provide a technical analysis of an additional subclass of speculative execution side channel vulnerabilities known as Speculative Store Bypass, SSB, which has been assigned, and they gave it CVE 2018-3639. SSB was independently discovered by Ken Johnson of the Microsoft Security Response Center, the MSRC, and Jan Thorne of Google Project Zero. Microsoft says, what is affected? And answers, AMD, ARM, and Intel CPUs. And it turns out in other reporting, IBM is there too with their chips. What is the risk? Microsoft says, Microsoft currently assesses the risk posed by this CVE, this SSB, to our customers as low. We are not aware of any exploitable instances of this vulnerability class in our software at this time, but we're continuing to investigate, and we encourage researchers to find and report any exploitable instances as part of our speculative execution side channel bounty program. Remember, that's the one. What was it, Leo? I think it's $250,000.
Yeah,
it's the one.
Yeah,
it times out at the end of this year, so you've got through 2018. But you know, they're offering a lot of money to anybody who can actually find an exploit. They say we will adapt our mitigation strategy for this problem, this SSB, as our understanding of the risk evolves. So they say, what is the mitigation? Microsoft has already released mitigations as part of our response to Spectre and Meltdown that are applicable to SSB in certain scenarios, such as reducing timer precision in Edge and IE. So because this is, as we've talked about before, it is subtle variations in the speed at which instructions execute, which is the root of this information leakage. If you just don't let the software know what time it is with sufficient resolution, you just shut down that exploit.
That's so funny. That's such a funny fix.
Isn't it? Yeah. And so this is a different thing, a very different thing, but it's still ultimately because, you know, the way the information leaks is in timing of individual instructions. So they said software developers can address individual instances of this exploit if they are discovered by introducing a speculation barrier instruction as described in blah, blah, blah. And that's that L fence that we've talked about. There's a long-standing instruction where if the processor hits it, it forces everything to complete before it goes on. And so what can be done and what has been done is this instruction can be salted through areas which are known to be sensitive in order to specifically block information leakage from that little bit of code. So the beauty of that, I mean, that's like the most labor-intensive, most error-prone solution. It's going to be because it can be hard to find every single instance where this might be necessary. But the beauty of it is that it's like virtually undetectable performance hit, because it's only in, you know, particular places that you're saying, okay, you need, everything needs to catch up before we move forward. So that L-fence instruction will slow down that tiny bit of code, but let everything else run at full speed. The hurtful mitigation is the next one. So I'll just continue. They said Microsoft is working with CPU manufacturers to assess the availability and readiness of new hardware features that can be used to resolve this. In some cases, these features will require a microcode or firmware update to be installed. And I should say, we're beyond May. Intel has already announced they're working on it. Microsoft plans to provide a mitigation that leverages the new hardware features in a future Windows update. So, in other words, when Intel has yet again new firmware for their across the family of chips, Microsoft will support that in Windows, probably not old Windows, but newer Windows. So then under preventing speculation techniques involving this SSB, they said, as we've noted in the past, one of the best ways to mitigate a vulnerability is by addressing the issue as close to the root cause as possible. In the case of SSB, there are a few techniques that can be used to prevent speculation techniques that rely on SSB as the speculation primitive. And then they talk about what I just was, this notion of the L-fence to force a catch-up. Then they say, as another mitigation, speculative store bypass disable. So that's SSBD. They say in some cases, CPUs can provide facilities, and Intel doesn't have it yet, but it's coming. That's thus the microcode update for inhibiting a speculative store bypass from occurring, and can therefore offer a categorical mitigation for SSB. They said AMD, ARM, and Intel have documented new hardware features that can be used by software to accomplish this. Microsoft is working with AMD, ARM, and Intel to assess the availability and readiness of these features. In some cases, these features will require a microcode or firmware update to be installed. And blah, blah, blah. Under generally applicable mitigations, they talk about the, as we were saying, the things that they've already done that can work. However, Intel acknowledges that it can be up to an 8% decrease in system performance if you do this global mitigation. That is, if with updated firmware, which offers a new bit in a feature register to that is the SSBD bit, the speculative store bypass disable, that will produce a performance hit. And Intel has announced new patches. Intel said we've already delivered the microcode update for variant 4 in beta form to OEM system manufacturers and system software vendors, and we expect it will be released into production BIOS and software updates after the coming weeks. That this mitigation will be set, and this is important, and Microsoft concurs with this. This mitigation will be set to off by default, providing customers the choice of whether to enable it. So they're saying, and of course the reason is it's a performance hit. They said we expect most industry software partners will likewise use the default off option. In this configuration, we have observed no performance impact. Well, yeah, because you didn't do anything. They said if enabled, we've observed a performance impact of approximately 2 to 8% based on overall scores for benchmarks like SysMark 2014 SE and the spec integer rate on client one and server two, or on client and server test systems. They said the same update also includes microcode that addresses variant 3A, which is that rogue system register read, which was previously documented publicly by ARM in January. We have not observed any meaningful performance impact on client or server benchmarks with the variant 3A mitigation. So those they expect, so that we've bundled these two microcode updates together to streamline the process for our industry partners and customers. This is something you will see us continue as we recognize that a more predictable and consolidated update process will be helpful to the entire ecosystem. In other words, they decided to, you know, group these together because why not? So what will happen is it looks like Microsoft plans to also leave this off unless we learn at some point that it's important to turn on, probably because it represents a very significant performance impact on our system, simply to turn this on. Maybe they will be able to go through and for example, sequester. One of the recommendations has been to recognize that it's no longer safe to mix the physical location of secrets with just less sensitive data, and that secret information needs to be physically placed somewhere in memory where it can be safe. And that's and so if you worry about, if you understand the nature of this kind of speculation and the attacks on it, it's possible to sequester your secrets so that they are not susceptible to this, even if you leave speculation on. So, and this is what we were talking about in the future, where the immediate worry has been to turn these things off that creates a performance impact, but probably over time we will be able to incrementally protect our secrets and then get back some performance that we initially lost. In this case, it looks like the hit of shutting down this SSB is so big that no one wants to do that, and they're expecting that it'll be possible to go in and both by softening timing resolution in browsers and eventually by protecting those sensitive areas with speculation prevention instructions like this LFENCE instruction, that it'll be possible to just now take responsibility for the potential security problems that speculation introduces, which as of the beginning of the year we are now soberly aware of. So bottom line, it's not the end of the world for users. Microsoft will be giving us Intel's updated firmware, which mostly will allow them to respond fast if a problem is found. That is, we'll have in our chips the ability to shut this down if a catastrophe comes to light, although it's no one expects that. So, more updates from Intel, more from Microsoft, but more awareness of problems, which the developers will have to keep in mind as they move forward and continue to massage the code to keep it secure.
Yeah. And I guess the other question is, what happened to the other six?
Yes, exactly. Why? Exactly. Because we heard there were six.
Heard the worst ones? We know about the worst ones, or there could be worse.
What kind of happened was that this leaked.
Okay.
Yeah. So both Microsoft and Google found this, and this was it has that 90-day
disclosure requirement.
Disclosure. Yeah. And in Jan's posting, it does show that they're in, I can't remember what he called it, grace period. They exceeded the 90, and they're now, they're being given an extension. So it could be that there's still six more problems that we'll be talking about as they come to light in the future. Wow.
Yeah.
It's what happens when you have a fundamental, hugely widespread, fundamental technology, this whole concept of caching and speculative execution, which suddenly everyone goes, oh, shoot, we really can't do that safely.
Yeah.
Yet everybody is.
Right. Whoops.
Wow.
Whoops. And now Everybody's banging on it, so I expect that we haven't heard the end of this anyway.
I think that's true.
Maybe other ones as well. Well, there you go. Spectre, I guess NG is next generation. Next.
Yep. Next. Yep. Spectre, next gen.
Next bad thing.
Yeah, that keeps on giving.
Keeps on giving. You'll find Steve is the guy who keeps on giving. You'll find his stuff at grc.com. Of course, the podcast is there. Just go to grc.com and you can download the audio versions, plus read the transcriptions, the human-created transcriptions of each show a few days after the show is done. You'll also find all the freebies that he gives away, like Shields Up and Perfect Paper, Password Squirrel, all the information about Squirrel, and his one sole piece of software that he sells, which is SpinRite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility. You can help support Steve and the show by buying a copy. You know, buy two. They're cheap.
They last a long time, for sure.
The site license is how many copies?
The idea is an individual can use them on all the machines they own.
Right.
We ask corporations that want to use them on all the machines they own to hold four licenses.
Four is all you need.
It's
unlimited.
And then a corporation can use it throughout their organization with my blessing.
It's very fair.
They do last a long time. So you get a lot of use out of those.
A fair way to do it. Thank you, Steve. GRC.com is where you'll find Steve at SGGRC on Twitter. He takes DMs, so you can always contact him there or leave a feedback form at grc.com/feedback. You can find this show audio and video on our website, twit.tv/SN, or wherever you subscribe to podcasts. If you want to watch us do it live, we had a big studio audience here today, Steve, from Louisiana, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, all big fans. And they're a little sleepy now, but that's okay.
Hi, everybody. Wake up.
You
wake
got
up.
The comfy chair. That's why he's very relaxed.
Ah, yeah.
If you want to be here, just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll make sure we do get a comfy chair out for you. And, of course, you can watch on the stream, too. You don't have to come all the way to Petaluma. Just go to twit.tv/live and watch the live stream. If you do that, make sure you're in the chat room. Nice bunch of people there at irc.twit.tv. That's about it on this side of the microphone. Steve, thanks so much.
Hey, my friend.
See you next
Talk to you next week. Security.